Beyond Barbarossa, episode 102. Peace? Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Redbeard Studio on the unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabeg people, also called Ottawa, Canada, never to be the next state of anywhere else. And I'm so fortunate to be joined in the Redbeard Studio today by my indispensable assistants, Daisy the Danger Doodle and Ragnar the Magnificent Ragdoll Cat. Last episode of Beyond Barbarossa described the final days of fighting on the Eastern Front of World War II. By mid-May 1945, the war was over. In Europe, that is. The Western Allies and the Red Army had met along the Elbe River and in other places along an agreed demarcation line that stretched across the continent. After the German forces had laid down their arms in Berlin, the remainders in Prague, Vienna, and Norway followed suit. Some fanatical SS units kept fighting until they were killed or killed themselves. The war was over. But was this peace? The quick answer is no. Fighting continued against the Empire of Japan, after all, and sporadically in other places too. One thing that was certain, the world would never go back to what it had been before 1939. The victors and survivors of the biggest, broadest, most destructive and bloody war in history now had to build a post-war world. Today's episode, number 102, will be about the immediate challenges facing those who would soon start creating this new world. But as I said, the fighting in mid-May, even into June and beyond, was still going on. So before we get to rebuilding the world, let's get to what else is happening in the world. May 15 to 16, two British destroyer squadrons sank the Japanese cruiser Haguro in the Strait of Malacca between the Malay Peninsula and the island of Sumatra. 23 May, U.S. B-29 Superfortresses firebomb Yokohama, a crucial industrial, military, and naval city, flattening nearly half of it. That same day, Uber Weasel, and I apologize to weasels actually, Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS and the worst example of the human race, commits suicide. 5 June, the day the Allies agreed to divide Germany into four zones of occupation, a huge Pacific typhoon damages the U.S. Third Fleet off the Philippines. It wrecks 146 U.S. aircraft, sinks three destroyers, damages many more, and 802 seamen were lost. 13 June, British forces capture Brunei on the island of Borneo. 22 June 1945, on the anniversary of the beginning of Operation Barbarossa, the largest land invasion in history, the Battle of Okinawa ends, the largest and bloodiest battle of the Pacific Theater of the War. It led to the loss of hundreds of American and British ships and planes, but the losses for the Japanese were, if numerically fewer, far greater in importance. 1,800 planes, most of them kamikaze suicide attackers, 15 ships, plus the Yamato, once the flagship of the Japanese Navy, the largest battleship ever constructed. In terms of people, the Americans suffered 50,000 casualties, including 12,500 dead. The British, 119 killed and 83 wounded. And the Japanese, up to 110,000 casualties, with 94,000 dead, including native Okinawans, conscripted to fighting for Japan. 5th July, U.S. General Douglas MacArthur declares the Philippines fully liberated. 10th July, planes from the U.S. Fast Carrier Task Force 38 bomb Tokyo for the first time. And on 16 July, the U.S. conducts the first test detonation of an atomic bomb at Alamogordo, New Mexico. And that's about as far ahead as I think we should go for this episode. Now, back to our main topic, peace. Let's look at the destruction of the Second World War in Europe. In the UK, 30% of homes were damaged or completely destroyed by aerial bombing. In France, the Netherlands, and Belgium, 20%. Industrial equipment in Western Europe was all heavily damaged or destroyed, as was the whole agricultural industry. Farm animals killed, fields bombed and mined, farm equipment destroyed, and manpower diverted to the front lines, or killed. Roads and railways were heavily damaged, especially rail hubs, which had been targets of heavy bombing by all sides. The damage got heavier the farther east you went. In Germany, 45% of all dwellings had been destroyed, according to the book by Harold Yahner, Aftermath, Life in the Fallout of the Third Reich, 1945 to 1955. In addition, the business centers of most cities were mostly reduced to rubble by Allied bombing and Soviet artillery. I'm sure you've seen the photos of Berlin, and I put more up on the website for this episode. But other cities, too, important centers of industry, had been heavily damaged, especially their industrial and commercial sectors. Cities like Hamburg, Dresden, Essen, Cologne, Frankfurt, you name it. Industrial output in Germany fell to a small fraction of pre-war levels. Roads, railways, bridges, canals, and other infrastructure were so heavily damaged that most cities had no water, gas, nor power. Berlin, most notably. Poland suffered 30% destruction of all buildings and 60% of its schools. Foreign armies had swept over Poland twice in the past 6 years, or three times, depending on your definitions. In 1939, Germany had invaded from the west, followed by the USSR from the east 2 weeks later. Then in 1941, Germany invaded the part of Poland it did not occupy in Operation Barbarossa. And then in 1944-45, the Red Army returned. Warsaw was almost completely wiped out in the summer of 1944. But that was not the only Polish city to suffer. Lwów had been fought over repeatedly, and Tarnopil had been razed to the ground, just as two examples. And yes, those are now Ukrainian cities, but in 1939, they were in Poland. Lithuania, Belarus, Latvia, and Estonia had also seen the front go over them twice, west to east, and then east to west. Ukraine, then part of the USSR, suffered more damage in the Second World War than any other country, and had seen some of the most extensive fighting of the war on the Eastern Front. The Wehrmacht swept across it in 1941, and then retreated in 1943 and 1944. However, as it was part of the USSR in those years, as I said, its statistics are often lumped in with the overall Soviet losses. Still, I'll mention a few, citing Orest Subtelny's book, Ukraine, A History. More than 700 cities and towns and 28,000 villages were destroyed, fully or partly. 16,000 industrial enterprises completely destroyed. 28,000 collective farms destroyed. Altogether, 40% of Ukraine's economic output was wiped out in the war between 1939 and 1945. Overall, the USSR had suffered mass destruction of its roads, railroads, rolling stock was destroyed or commandeered for military use. But by the end of the war, the picture gets complicated. You can't really understand it just by looking at statistics. When Germany invaded in 1941, 60% of the Soviet Union's productive capacity of coal, iron, and aluminum was in the western part of the country, the areas that Germany swiftly occupied. The Soviets famously relocated a lot of their factories to the Urals and points farther east, but still, their industrial output fell by a third between 1940 and 1942 and did not recover until well after the war. Initially, that recovery was due to the production of war materiel, not the kinds of things that a peacetime civilian economy needs. The Germans not only destroyed Soviet industries, they stole a lot of equipment, shipping it westward to use themselves. Damage to infrastructure like roads, railways, canals, and so on was even more extensive. But statistics are hard to come by, I've looked. Soviet record keeping was inaccurate and incomplete at best. And I found that any numbers that look solid, I'm pretty sure they're exaggerated. That's the situation on destruction of land and property. But the real story of the aftermath of the Eastern Front is the people. The millions of displaced persons, as they were called, civilians and former soldiers in the cities, in the countryside, and on the roads across Europe. The destruction of 20 to 45% of homes meant that millions of people had to live, eat, and sleep somewhere, often out in the open. Historian Antony Beevor paints an evocative picture with the help of journalists who were there. The chaos which the Nazis had brought upon the entire continental landmass was demonstrated by the hundreds of thousands of displaced persons. On the roads of Germany today, wrote Gottfried Blunden, there is the whole story of Europe, or the world for that matter. Millions of forced laborers brought to the Reich from France, Italy, Low Countries, Central Europe, the Balkans, and above all the Soviet Union began to make their way home on foot. An old woman traveler, Vasily Grossman noted, is walking away from Berlin, wearing a shawl on her head. She looks exactly as if she were going on a pilgrimage amid the expanse of Russia. She is holding an umbrella across her shoulder. A huge aluminum casserole is hung by its ear on the umbrella's handle. End quote. The mass of DPs, as they became somewhat disparagingly known, comprised several different groups. There were civilians whose homes or entire communities had been destroyed, prisoners of war from Allied countries, prisoners of war from Germany, and forced laborers kidnapped from German-occupied countries to do the work on the farms and factories to replace German workers fighting and dying on the front lines, or to be domestic servants in the homes of senior German officers and Nazi officials, and, if they were pretty young girls, sex slaves. To quote from Harold Jahner's Aftermath again, there were also between 8 and 10 million prisoners who had been torn from their homelands and forced into the concentration and labor camps within Germany, from which they had now been liberated. Most of them had only the clothes on their backs. The release did not assure the prisoners a homecoming, even if their homes still existed. Some had had the good fortune to be provided with food by Allied soldiers immediately after liberation, and returned to their homeland shortly afterwards. Those who were less fortunate were left to wander through the defeated country whose inhabitants had recently enslaved them and, in many cases, murdered their families. But most people waited, weak and dispirited, in new camps or even old ones, to see what fate had in store for them. A further 12.5 million people drifted through Germany in groups of various sizes, exiles from the eastern territories that were now no longer German, mostly passing through regions that were unfamiliar to them and in which it was made very clear that that they were not welcome. They had no choice but to find a place where they could stay. End quote. The victorious Allies now occupied Germany and all the countries it had once conquered in Eastern Europe. That meant caring for all these displaced, homeless, and wounded people was their responsibility. Let's dig into that after this break.
Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more on my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Welcome to part two of Episode 102 of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast to focus on the full story of the Eastern Front of World War II. We're looking at the end of the war in 1945, the immediate aftermath of this, the most destructive war in history. After disarming the German forces following their surrender, the Allies' next priority was to care for the displaced people, 40 million of them. There were over 10 million German soldiers, now prisoners of war, 9 million civilians whose homes had been destroyed or had been evacuated to the countryside, 8 to 10 million forced laborers from other countries, another 12 million ethnic Germans who fled the Eastern territories, now occupied by the USSR, East Prussia, Pomerania, and Silesia. And then the Allied POWs, liberated by the victors, anxious to return home. With the destruction of homes, towns, and cities, the only thing the Allies could do to first house these people at first was to put them in camps. They had no choice but to put a million German POWs into Rheinweinsenlager, or Rhine Meadow camps, open fields surrounded by barbed wire. It took till the end of June, 2 months, to furnish these open-air camps with roofed kitchens, infirmaries, and even latrines. There were hundreds of thousands of Allied prisoners of war still in Europe by the end of the war, and repatriating them was probably the Allies' next priority. An Australian journalist, Geoffrey Blunden, mentioned in Part 1, encountered a group of young POWs from the U.S., half-starved in captivity. Blunden described their xylophone ribs, sunken cheeks, thin necks, and gangling arms. Apparently, they acted a little hysterical, he said, when meeting anyone else who spoke English. Quote, some American prisoners whom I met this morning seemed to me to be the most pitiful of all I have seen. Since their capture, they had been moved almost constantly from one place to another. They told stories of comrades clubbed to death by German guards merely for breaking line to grab sugar beets from the fields. They were more pitiful because they were only boys drafted from nice homes in a nice country, knowing nothing about Europe. not tough like Australians, or shrewd like the French, or irreducibly stubborn like the English. They just didn't know what it was all about. End quote. Those were the former soldiers on both sides. For most civilians, conditions were worse, especially for those who were far from home, whether that was in Czechoslovakia, Poland, or Russia. They wandered along the broken roads, which were also clogged with military traffic. If lucky, they found a bed in a relative's home, but more often in bunkers, parks, in doorways, or under the rubble of a destroyed building. Food and medical treatment were in short supply. What we today call supply chains were damaged or broken, especially in Eastern Europe. While those under direct military care, especially by the Americans, could depend on adequate food, civilians had to depend on their wits. In the cities, foraging was a prized skill. Sometimes the homeless would be lucky enough to find a cache of canned or preserved foods that had survived the shelling, but this was not reliable. Journalist Ursula von Kardoff recorded this in September 1945, 4 months after hostilities ended. Terrible images. Rubble, amongst which wandered creatures that no longer seemed to be of this world. Homecomers in ragged, wadded uniforms, covered with boils, creeping along makeshift crutches. Living corpses. End quote. Such a situation led to a lively black market in food, medicine, and other essentials. But of course, not everyone had the means to afford this. According to Janer, a mere 5 weeks after the fall of Berlin, the cafes on one street, the Kurfürstendamm, were open again, and those with means, however they had them, could sit on the terraces and watch people go by. People who, often as not, were foraging and scrounging just to keep their children alive. The Allied occupation forces did what they could to help, and it was a lot. But with the sheer numbers of people in need, sometimes accommodating refugees meant commandeering German homes, even forcing the German occupiers out. The Allies even housed refugees in former German prisoner and concentration camps. Of course, they provided more food and other supplies. Still, these accommodations were grim. And putting so many desperate people together in such conditions inevitably led to conflicts. Again, from Anthony Beevor. Among the displaced persons were many prisoners who had become brutalized by their treatment and longed for revenge on the Germans. Roving freely, looting and raping, they spread chaos and fear. Provost marshals gave orders that justice was to be administered on the spot. Those identified as murderers and rapists were summarily shot, a British soldier recorded. Yet German civilians who came to the occupation authorities to complain about the theft of food by forced laborers received little sympathy. Only a tiny minority had shown any compassion towards them when the Nazis had been in power. End quote. Janer adds the mass murders of their companions have produced hatred and a thirst for revenge. In some cases, groups of them attacked villages and isolated houses, murdering and looting. One particularly brutal attack occurred near Bremen on 20 November 1945. A group of Polish DPs from the relatively well-appointed Tirpitz camp invaded a house where a family of 13 people were staying that night, including children and young adults. After the residents had handed over their food and their few valuable objects, they were taken to the basement and shot. Only the 43-year-old Wilhelm Hamelmann survived by playing dead. He later attracted considerable attention by publicly forgiving the perpetrators and pleading for them to be pardoned, despite the fact that they had killed his wife and children. The German POWs, dispirited, disciplined, and dutiful to the point of submissiveness, had made life surprisingly easy for the occupying soldiers, while their displaced victims were, understandably, more agitated and rebellious. This led to bizarre alliances between Allied and German law enforcers. Raids on the camps in search of weapons and stolen or black market goods were often carried out by Allied soldiers and German police working together, which the DPs, of course, saw as an intolerable provocation. Stones flew, truncheons were swung, rage and bitterness rose on both sides. End quote. And then there's the Red Army. You all know that Germany was divided into four occupation zones after the war, for the USSR, the USA, the UK, and France. Similarly, Berlin itself, as well as Vienna, were divided into four such zones. But this did not happen immediately on 8th of May, 1945. In fact, for nearly 2 months, the Soviets had total control over Berlin. They did work hard to get the power, heat, and water working again, and they worked to clear the rubble, mostly to ease their own movement through the city. It was the German civilians who did most of this work. In Berlin, the Trümmerfrauen, rubble women, about 26,000 of them, became icons of the cleanup and reconstruction, and I put some pictures on the webpage for this episode. In some cities, particularly in Western Germany, former members of the Nazi Party were ordered to clear away the rubble themselves, on the argument that they were responsible for this catastrophe. German POWs were also assigned to clearance work. At first, the officials organizing this work selected SS members as punishment details, but eventually the sheer amount of work required, they take anyone they could find. According to one estimate, the war had produced 500 million cubic meters of rubble. Finally, professional construction crews with the requisite equipment were brought in. But back to the Soviet occupation. Last episode describes some of the looting that happened when the Red Army arrived in the German capital. And it wasn't restricted to soldiers. Officers, even senior officers, even at the very top, took not only food, but luxury items away for themselves. Marshal Georgi Zhukov, who had been appointed military governor of Berlin by Stalin, he himself shipped boxcars of paintings, rugs, furniture, gold plate, and more luxury stuff east to his home in Russia. Something cited when he was put on trial by his political enemies in the USSR years later. Let's take another break. And when we come back, we'll look at the issue of returning displaced people to their homes.
This episode is brought to you by the Eastern Front Trilogy, the true story of a Canadian, Maurice Burry, drafted into the Soviet Red Army in 1941, just in time to be thrown between the jaws of the USSR and Nazi Germany at the launch of the greatest land invasion in history, the monstrous war called Operation Barbarossa. In three volumes, Army of Worn Souls, Under the Nazi Heel, and Walking Out of War. The Eastern Front Trilogy is the story of the largest and deadliest side of the Second World War, seen through the eyes of a man who was there from the earliest days in 1941, through Germany's grinding occupation of Ukraine, and finally to the savage end of the war in Berlin. You can find the three individual volumes as ebooks exclusively on Amazon, or purchase a three-volume complete paperback on any online book retailer or at your local bookstore. To learn more about the Eastern Front Trilogy, visit scottburryauthor.com.
As Scott elegantly describes in each episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the war on the Eastern Front was truly gargantuan, both in terms of its geography and its destructiveness. But given that there is so much territory to cover, and that so many millions of men were involved in the fighting, it's perhaps inevitable that some battles from the Eastern Front get overlooked. I'm David Sumner, and I'm the host of Europe at War, a weekly podcast exploring lesser-known battles and stories of the Second World War, with a particular focus on the Eastern Front. From the drama of thousands of trapped German soldiers and terrified civilians attempting to break out of the Halber Pocket, to the unexpected and blistering counterattack launched by German forces on the Red Army during the Battle of Bautzen, many of the Eastern Front's most dramatic battles, particularly those which happened towards the end of the war, have long been neglected by historians, and their stories have remained untold. until now. So to hear these incredible tales from the Eastern Front and more, check out Europe at War, available on all podcast platforms. Thank you. Now let's get back to the show.
Welcome to part 3 of episode 102 of Beyond Barbarossa. It's time to find out about how the Allies returned displaced people back to their homes, sometimes when they didn't want to go. Returning home was the hope for the Germans and other people in the cities and towns where they had lived before the war. But for those 10 million forced laborers from Eastern Europe and the 10 million German POWs from across the country, the issue was returning home over a long distance while ensuring enough food, water, and other essentials until they got there. They crammed the roads across Europe, roads already filled with military vehicles and cratered by war. According to Hungarian-American journalist Hans Habe, it was a world on wheels, military vehicles and gypsy caravans, tanks and circuses, victory and misery, everything motorized. And in between, like a narrow stream, trickled the other world, the world on foot, the German world. Men and women roaming the pitted high roads. Some were looking for a crust of bread, others for their children. Some cursed the conquerors, others did business with them. Whenever a convoy stopped, the pedestrians stopped. Here and there, a loaf of bread was handed out from a truck or a tank. End quote. I'll turn again to Harald Janer, who describes it so vividly. After the war, there were between 8 and 10 million forced laborers to be returned to their homelands. These were unimaginable mass transports in which the lives of individuals were once again put at risk. There were long freight trains in which the liberated people traveled home cheering and singing, but also many in which they sat dispirited and depressed, in the certainty that the home they had once known no longer existed. The number of displaced persons was so high that their repatriation was calculated in daily rates. In the best times, in May 1945, Allied forces managed to return 107,000 people per day. End quote. That's staggering. As Janer pointed out, for many, there was no home to return to, nor did all those people want to return to the USSR. Ukrainians and Baltic peoples especially did not wish to go back to the communist yoke. One example was my father-in-law, Maurice Burry, subject of walking out of war. A Canadian born in Montreal to Ukrainian immigrant parents, he returned with his family to their farm in eastern Poland during the Great Depression. Then, as you know from this podcast and other places, eastern Poland was seized by the Soviets under the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939. At that point, Maurice became a citizen of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic and drafted into the Red Army in 1941. 6 years as a comrade was enough for him. So, when the fighting was over, Maurice walked out of war. It took him another 2 years to return to Montreal. And if you want to know more details, the book Walking Out of War is the third volume of the Eastern Front trilogy, and you can find it anywhere you buy books. Perhaps more well-known is the fate of the Cossacks, horse soldiers from southern Russia, mostly, who opposed communism. The Cossack Cavalry Corps, organized in 1943 as a unit of the Wehrmacht, fought in several operations on the Eastern Front. It was administratively transferred into the Waffen or Armed SS in December 1944, but that didn't really change anything, not their officers, not their uniforms. The Cossack Corps retreated to Austria at the end of the war, where they surrendered to British forces, hoping to be able to resettle in the West. But the Yalta Agreement of February 1945 stipulated that all POWs from the territory of the USSR be returned there, by force if necessary. And so, despite pleas and pressure, the British and American soldiers guarding them had to use truncheons and rifle butts to force the Cossacks onto trucks that would return them to the motherland. Some Allied soldiers refused to take part in this activity. Some of the Cossacks did escape, they made their way to the West, but those who returned to Russia, most of them, were sent to labor camps in the Gulag, where they stayed until after Stalin died in 1953. If they survived, they were released, but never had their full rights restored. Such rights as Soviet citizens had, anyway. All the officers were tried by the communists in 1945 and executed. The Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian, and other forced laborers from Soviet lands, called Hivis, Hilfswilliger or Auxiliary Volunteers, were also often loath to return home. When they did get there, they were frequently accused of collaborating with the enemy. POWs captured by the Germans from 1941 to 1945 were accused by the communists of desertion. Millions of POWs and Hivis were also sent to the gulags. Antony Beaver puts it this way. The population of the gulag and of forced labor battalions swelled to its largest level. The new convicts included both civilians and an estimated 3 million Red Army soldiers, sentenced for having collaborated as Hivis or simply for having surrendered. Large numbers of others, including 11 generals, were executed after brutal interrogations at the screening centers run by SMERSH and the NKVD. Abandoned by incompetent or terrified superiors in 1941, Soviet soldiers had starved in the indescribable horrors of German camps. Now they found themselves treated as traitors of the motherland because they had failed to kill themselves. End quote. The USSR did not finish repatriating its people, whether they wanted it or not, until December 1946. In all, 5.5 million people, including 1,833,567 prisoners of war, 339,000 of them, men and women who had fought in the Red Army and been captured by the Germans, were sent to the Gulag, the archipelago of prison camps across northern Russia and Siberia. Another 1.2 million were sent to forced labor battalions, which were probably worse. There is one more group of displaced people to talk about. Some 12 million Germans from the eastern territories of East Prussia, Pomerania, and Silesia. In 1945, these areas were occupied by the Red Army, and before long, they'd be incorporated into the republics of the Soviet Union or its puppet states. The USSR conducted a rarely mentioned campaign of ethnic cleansing in East Prussia. As of 1940, its population was about 2.2 million, centered on the ancient fortress city of Königsberg. Since its founding in the 13th century, it had never been severely damaged in war, until two Royal Air Force raids in August 1944 nearly destroyed it. Then came the Battle of Königsberg, when the Red Army stormed the city in early April 1945. As the Red Army advanced along the Baltic coast, the German population fled westward. By the end of May 1945, the civilian population of 2.2 million had been reduced to 193,000. 300,000 of the difference being killed in the war or by starvation and disease. East Prussia ceased to exist, divided between soon-to-be Soviet Lithuania and Russia. Königsberg, the city, was renamed Kaliningrad, and the surrounding area, making up most of what had been East Prussia, became the Russian exclave of Kaliningrad Oblast. Pomerania, eastern Germany near the Baltic Sea, and Silesia, farther south, became part of Poland. The maps were redrawn. So May 1945 saw the end of fighting by Nazi Germany against the Allies, but the situation was not something we can call peace. Combat continued in the Far East, and in the closer East, where the Ukrainian insurgent army continued to resist Soviet occupation in the Carpathian Mountains until the 1950s. It's impossible to call this situation in Europe peaceful. Not with armies, refugees, released prisoners, and officials from governments, aid organizations, more moving in all directions all the time, all scrambling to find enough food, shelter, warmth, and security. Not with war criminals trying to evade justice and opponents to communism trying to elude the NKVD. effectively the enforcers of Stalin's conformity. And most people just trying to put their lives together again after 6 years of war and 12 years of Nazism. In Iron Curtain, The Crushing of Eastern Europe, 1944 to 1956, Anne Applebaum writes, "In 1939 and again in 1944 and 1945, the Red Army and the NKVD would arrest not only Nazis and collaborators in their newly conquered territories, but anyone who might theoretically oppose Soviet administration. Social Democrats, anti-fascists, businessmen, bankers, and merchants, often the same people targeted by the Nazis. Although there were civilian casualties in Western Europe, as well as incidents of theft, misbehavior, and abuse perpetrated by the British and American armies, for the most part, the Anglo-Saxon troops were trying to kill Nazis, not potential leaders of the liberated nations. And for the most part, they treated the resistance leaders with respect and not suspicion." End quote. But here in May-June 1945, we are on the threshold of the reshaping of the world. The Bretton Woods Conference had established the International Monetary Fund and the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development in July 1944. The United Nations Conference on International Organization had drawn in 50 nations in April 1945, and their representatives would sign its charter in June. And coming up, the Potsdam Conference would set out the future of Germany and redraw the borders of Europe. That's a lot to dig into, but I've been talking for a long time now, and you need a break. The next episode of Beyond Barbarossa will go live on 22nd June. Of course, you know that's the anniversary of the beginning of Operation Barbarossa. I'm going to do something special for that. That's just a hint. And then I'm going to take a good break, returning in August to look at the Potsdam Conference. After that, there's a real right turn coming in this podcast. So stay tuned. Until next time, thank you for listening to this episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast that focuses on the full story of the Eastern Front of World War II. As usual, I put up some historical photos on the webpage for this episode. Go to beyondbarbarossa.ca and click or tap episodes. I want to say a special thanks to all who support the podcast through Patreon. And I can't believe I'm still saying this 4 years later. But until all Ukrainian refugees can return home safely, your financial support goes to charities that help Ukrainian refugees. Before I sign off, I want to ask you again to hit that follow or subscribe button. If you have a second, give it a rating. I like 5 stars, but please, tell me the rating you believe it deserves. And if you have a little more time, a review would mean a lot. It also helps others find the show. And if you know someone who is into history, curious about the Eastern Front of the Second World War or the Second World War in general, why not tell them about Beyond Barbarossa? If you have something to say, to add, to ask, you have a comment, even a correction, let me know. I'd love to hear from you. Send an email to scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca or leave a comment or post on the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. You could also reach me on Blue Sky, Scott the Writer, Instagram, Scott Berry Author, Threads, TikTok, and YouTube. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Berry. Morse code sound effects by Thane Brown. I'm Scott Burry. Until we meet again, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina. Viva le Canada.